We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello everyone, I'm Ben Johnson and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello, everyone. I'm here with two-time U.S. champion, U.S. Chess Hall of Fame member, Alex Yermolinsky. Alex, thank you so much for coming on to Perpetual Chess.
Ben, thank you for having me. I really look forward to our talk.
Okay, so I think that you're going to be a popular choice, especially in the United States. You're basically a chess legend. When I was growing up, you were a fixture at the U.S. tournaments, the U.S. Open and the World Open, and you won those tournaments several times. And now you've got a popular show on ICC, and you've been doing some announcing for the Pro Chess League. So I think people enjoy hearing you shoot from the hip. I wanted to ask what else you're up to these days, Alex, when you're not broadcasting online.
Well, I do have some private students, although I keep the number to a minimum. Well, I have currently, I think, 5 or 6 students. And that's very unusual, because guys in sort of in my position, put it this way, like Gregory Kaidanov would be a great example. You know, they have a lot of students. And, well, I look in different direction, put it this way. You mentioned broadcasting and the recording videos and all that, and group lessons also.
Okay.
I can go into some details on that, you know, and that's my preferred method of reaching out to chess public and also making a living.
Right. Why do you prefer group lessons?
Well, I think, you know, that private lessons, one-on-one lessons, they only work for certain kinds of people. You know, that has to be a lot of responsibility coming from the other side. And that usually comes with age and experience in life. When grown-ups, I put it grown-ups rather than adults, because obviously a large contingent of students comes from kids. So when grown-ups, take lessons. They usually, no, they pay for them themselves, right?
Right.
So they it's not like they know what they want, but they kind of realize that whatever they want, they can only get if the if their own input doesn't just equal the input from the coach, but doubles, triples, or quadruples it. You know, so that's the only way. With many kids these days, particularly the more advanced ones that take lessons from multiple coaches, well, they become, no, I don't know, they just sit there and they listen pretty much. They don't, they hardly input any of their own. And at times it gets frustrating because, well, I don't really know if I'm getting through to the guy and all that. You know, so that's what led me to group lessons, because in group settings, it's different. People, no, there are always more active people and some less active in that group. I give you examples from my experience with Chess University, which is an offshoot of chess.com, but now it's an independent business. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to have a live group lesson later today. But with these guys, there is a group of 10 to 12 people, and they interact during the lesson. So they kind of pull each other, you know, like, well, they pull together. They're in competition, but with each other in some ways, but I think it's helpful.
Okay. And do you do any group lessons in person, or is everything you do online right now?
No, I don't do anything in person for chess.
How did you end up
in everything's online. Everything's online.
Okay. And I understand that you live in South Dakota now?
Yeah. I've been here for almost 10 years. In the fall, it's going to be exactly 10 years since I moved here to Sioux Falls.
Okay.
From San Francisco, California.
And what? Why did you decide to move?
It's a combination of reasons. You know, obviously, the top reason is the cost of living. Well, now, these days, if a chess player makes his money over the internet anyway, right?
Right.
Then whatever it is, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, like that. What matters really how much you spend. And for me, raising a family, well, I still have, I have two kids now living with me. And our older son, he's first year in college here. And the younger one, a girl, she is finishing middle school, so there's still some years to go, right?
Right. Yeah, having
so that was part of the decision, but it's not the only one. Well, I kind of grew tired of big cities. I grew up, I was born and grew up in Leningrad. Now, of course, St. Petersburg, a city of almost 4 million people. Now, probably even more. I don't know. And then I live in some large cities. I already mentioned San Francisco. And with time, I don't know, with passage of time, I just kind of grew tired of the traffic and general hustle and bustle. So I was looking for a quieter place for myself.
And how'd you decide on, are you actually in Sioux Falls or just?
I'm actually in the city of Sioux Falls, yeah.
Okay. And how did you decide on Sioux Falls?
I had visited before because they're still around. They're just not doing as much as they used to. As a husband and wife team of, I don't know, important is probably not, maybe the right word there. She was a city council chairperson and is a state senator, he was. Anyway, Dee and David Knudsen, and they used to organize a tournament here in Sioux Falls. They started, I believe, sometime in the late 1990s. It was called the Governor's Cup, because then the governor of South Dakota was a guest of the tournament, and he would make an appearance and all that, give a speech. So Governor's Cup. So I visited, and I played in that tournament a few times. So I got to know Sioux Falls a little bit. So when time came for me to move out of California, I thought of Sioux Falls, and my wife also visited before. So we made our decision. We moved here.
Okay. And for the listeners who don't know, Mr. Yermolinsky's wife is a great chess player in her own right, Camila Baginski. So what are the, So what's it like being married to a chess player? Do you think?
Well, I can't compare to because I've been before that I've been married to non-chess players. Well, anyway, tell me the truth. You know, it's not really important. You know, she is a great person. She's very soft and gentle, and well, working on contrast with me somewhat. You know, I'm a little rough around the edges.
Okay,
she kind of smooths it over, and we work as a family. We work well together. And, but we never play chess with each other. We discuss chess, of course. But, well, if your next question is how you guys play each other, the answer is, well, we never do.
Right. Okay, not surprising. And do your kids play at all?
Well, they used to play. Currently, they're not. Well, that often happens in chess families. The kids start off, but then they move on to different things.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't want to do stuff that my parents did, right? They're both civil engineers. They were divorced at that time, but I wanted to be something different. I think it's only natural.
Right. Okay. All right. So you mentioned that you're from Leningrad, obviously a place with legendary chess culture, Spassky, Korchnoi. Previous podcast guest Peter Svidler, we're all from there. So you were a product of that. The Soviet chess school isn't your favorite term from it, but you're a product of the chess culture there. So would you mind telling your listeners a little bit about just briefly get into your background and how you discovered chess? I know you also discussed this in your book, which we'll talk about in a bit. But anyway,
yeah. Well, I don't mind.
Okay.
Well, yeah. The Soviet school of chess, I know, yeah, this term is used and overused, and I actually prefer that the way you phrased it. Well, chess culture, obviously, it kind of permeates, and where I grew up, okay, Leningrad, the second largest city in the Soviet Union, well, city of educated people, put it this way. And chess was part of it. There are a lot of people, including my dad, who played chess. He never played in tournaments, but he knew how to play. But it wasn't him who taught me the moves. It was my maternal grandfather who taught me how to play chess. But then he passed away when I wasn't even 7, when he passed away. And I had nobody to play chess with. And I don't know, I guess my mother, she took me to a local chess club. It would be equivalent of a community center, right? Because we lived a bit in the outskirts of the city. Anyway, so there was a little chess room over there. But after I went there a few times, a coach there, I don't remember his name. I don't remember him at all. Actually told my mother that, oh, your son is talented and you should try to bring him to main a city chess club, I don't phrase it correctly, for young players. And the chess club, which was part of the Pioneer's Palace.
Right, okay.
The general, you know, like this big, big community center, city community center with all sorts of activities. Think of YMCA only, it was just much bigger and it had a lot of things, you know, from ballet to fencing to literature, to chess, and all things like this. And that thing I started for me when I was... Okay, so I have to make adjustments because we were starting school 1 year later. So I was in second grade, but that would be equivalent of third grade here. Okay. So I was 8 years old. And now it's interesting, Ben. I gotta tell you that it wasn't easy to get there. Later on, when I became a known player there, I, along with my teammates on that scholastic team, we were helping our coaches to select new young kids for the club. So it was almost like an exam of sorts. So there's a whole bunch of kids, you know, waiting, and there are coaches there sitting in front of chess boards. and some of older kids there, better players, and it's totally random, you know. So like this next kid's turn, right? So he comes in, sits in front of you, and well, how does a coach figure out if this kid has talent? He has like maybe 10 or 15 minutes. It's very iffy, right?
Yeah. Did he give you a puzzle, or what did he do?
Talked and, no, not any kind of mate in one things, but of course they would play a few moves there. So coaches would determine, you know, if the kid...
Was it
it's not just like the kid memorizes moves.
Right, I was going to ask about that.
Exactly.
If it was from the starting position or not. Because of-
well, then you move the pieces a little bit. Maybe the coach will throw some pieces around, you know, like following some kind of known opening line, and they would say, now, what do you think of this? Have you ever played this before? I mean, what should white do here? What should black do here? But, I mean, they did their best, you know. Probably some of maybe greater chess talent, you know, fell through the cracks. I mean, it's probably inevitable. But they did catch some good players, and I was very fortunate to be selected for this program.
So it sounds like you were maybe already intermediate level at this point. Like, if you were to try to put a rating on when this selection process happened, what is it possible? Do you think you could estimate?
Well, the thing is that rating is a product of tournament chess, and tournament chess is what I never had any experience with. And what happens, at least what happened to me, what was happening to me then, I remember I was getting too excited. I mean, I was bursting with ideas. I wanted to play my moves, and often I would overlook opponent's check on my king.
Right.
So you can't really put me like, I don't know, at 1200, right?
Right.
You know, if I don't notice that my king is in check. But the coaches were patient with me, and I guess with others as well. So I think by the end of my first year there, I was probably around 1200, 1300.
Okay. And then you came up through the system and you continued to improve. You've written at length about this in your outstanding book, The Road to Chess Improvement. And you wrote about the fact that it took you a while to become grandmaster. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about the experience of trying to break through that barrier?
Yeah, but before that, I'll tell you that it took me a while to get on the next level, always. I mean, when I was young and attending this chess club, there was another thing about it. Aside of being good enough to be there, you also have to get there physically, right? I mean, some kids, they lived kind of far away, you know. It's pretty large, spread out city and all that, you know. So some parents just weren't able to take them there, and they didn't want their kids to take public transportation. Obviously, it was a long time ago. But I insisted that I can do it myself. So I was just coming home from school and just basically dropping off my bag, you know, eating something, and then off for this one-hour-long ride, you know, to the chess club. So that thing kind of like it's a test for kids' determination to do this.
Right. How often were the classes? How often were you making
We played twice a week, and one day a week was a theoretical seminar group lesson kind of thing. But we always stick around, you know, after that, because we play a lot of pickup games and all that, you know. And, Eventually, I started using the books, chess books that they had there. They won't let you check them out, but you could take the book off the shelf, you know, and use it. Yeah, so this is how it was. But I don't really know why, you know, but some kids, there was always a kid, you know, that would come out of nowhere and just win the tournament and move to the next category. But I was taking my time. But eventually, you know, I caught up with them all. By the time I was 15, I won for the first time the city high school championship.
Which is no small feat in Leningrad.
I guess, you know, because I crashed and burned the next year. But then I won it again at 17, when I was 17, which was my final year, because we had 10 years in school. from 7 to 17. As far as the Grandmaster thing, well, I mean, I don't know. After I graduated and I went on with my life, you know, life started getting in the way of chess. And I honestly, Ben, I was not the most focused person on anything, including my chess. So on and off, you know, I would drift away and do some other things. And maybe I wasn't, maybe that was one of the reasons. And
so did you, before we get back to the chess, when you were drifting, did you go to university or what else would you
do? Yeah, I went to a couple of schools, you know, dropped out of them, you know. Then I took a job, you know, in a large factory, in an assembly line job.
Wow.
So I had that, you know, well, and then eventually I joined the army. I was in the Red Army for many years. And this is where I made my return to chess. Let's say that I probably became serious about chess again when I was somewhere like 21, okay. Something like this.
And what do you think your FIDE strength was at that point?
No, I know exactly what it was because I already had a rating.
Okay.
I think when I was 21, I think I was 2300.
Okay. So yeah, pretty good, but not necessarily Grandmaster tracks.
Of course not, you know. Some of the kids I played, you know, when I was 15, well, from other cities, well, they were already famous grandmasters. Yusupov, Psakis.
Wow.
Legends. Kasparov.
You played Kasparov. On chess games, you've got 7 games against Kasparov, one of them a blitz game. How memorable are those games for you? I know you were pretty young.
No, well, we played 3 times. Well, when we were young, I'm 5 years his senior.
Okay.
And then we played, I guess, 3 times. Much later, when he was world champion, including that blitz game.
Okay.
So I think the total number is 6, but. Well, they're memorable, of course, because Noel is the best player of my generation by far, and arguably the greatest player ever. You can make a case for that.
Is that your opinion?
I have a hard time comparing players from different eras, and because the society is different, and I mean, I kind of know ways of society, you know, from the 1970s onward, right? Because that's my lifespan. But what do I know about the 19th century or
right.
the 1920s or 1930s?
Okay,
I mean, people live different lives. They had different objectives. And obviously, your life has impact on your chess. And, that's why I find it real hard to compare. Capablanca and Karpov. I don't know how to compare them.
Right.
Maybe some similarities in style, but much less than people think. Because I think, for example, Karpov was more like a player. I wouldn't use the word gambler because, no, it implies different things now. But he's just a player, the guy who wanted to play and win. While Capablanca, I don't know if he was really driven by that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think there was just, I think as people, they were different as human beings. But you might say, yeah, well, playing on the positional factors, mainly basing their decisions on positional factors. But the Rubov were way beyond the traditional, pawn structure, rigid approach that is often mistaken for positional play. Like, okay, well, there is a square on e5. I put my knight there and that's it, you know, the knight dominates. That's too simple. The 1800 players, they learn that stuff. Or the 7th rank with the rooks or passed pawn. General positional principles. For positional players of Capablanca and Karpov level, well, obviously it was dynamic. So they looked at all those things in a different settings, in settings of a dynamic flow in chess game, where things are not going to stay the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so getting back to your pursuit of the Grandmaster title, so you're in your 20s in the Red Army, and you're regaining your interest in chess. So what concrete steps did you take? I mean, you talk about this at length in your book, but for the listeners who haven't read it, what how did you finally what changes did you make to progress from 2300 up to the level that you the world class level that you reached later on?
I should credit people around me, my friends, because I always had had a hard time working on chess by like by myself. Well, later maybe I learned a little bit, but much later, already when I was in the United States and in my 30s. But when I was in my 20s, I needed a partner. I needed a friend. You know, and I was very fortunate, blessed, you know, to have people who were my close friends, and we worked in chess together. Well, different things we did, you know. Well, I learned also not to be, in this kind of partnership, I learned not to necessarily be the leader, you know, so I would often leave it to my friend, my partner, to point us to a certain direction that interests him. For example, a great friend of mine, he became a grandmaster too. Now, still lives in St. Petersburg, Valery Loginov. He originally was not from there. He's from Uzbekistan, but he moved to Leningrad to study. And we became fast friends. And he was really fascinated with the endgame. So we worked a lot on the endgame, looking at all sorts of endgame positions. Well, for example, once we decided to undertake a very ambitious project, we decided to recreate theory of all basic positions, rook versus bishop with small number of pawns on both sides. Okay, so, well, we knew we could get to some sources, right? There were books. But we decided to set it all aside and study everything from scratch. So we were sitting there, throwing the pieces around, you know, and writing down our conclusions. Imagine this project. Actually, I don't know. I think he may still have the copy of that. You know, I don't know how close we came to the truth, but I guess close enough, because in my future chess career and now in my teaching, I'm very comfortable in those positions. I really know what it is and what's going on. Rarely make mistakes in those, almost never.
And you also mentioned in your book that you started, when you started to progress, you started to place a lot more emphasis on going over your games.
Well, that's essential because, I read a book by Alexander Alekhine, well, great world champion. This was one of the first books that I ever had. Well, growing up, well, we didn't have a whole lot of stuff and, Mom, you know, didn't have a lot of spare money to buy chess books. I only had a few. But Alekhine's Best Games, 300 Games, was one of my first books. And he stated it. He said, well, your work begins with learning things about yourself. He says that's 90% of your work. And so everything has to go through studying of your own games. I guess, Ben, you can also say that, you don't want to repeat the same mistakes. So if you don't acknowledge them, then you repeat them, right?
Yeah, try to make different mistakes.
Well, yeah. Okay, making different mistakes and all that. True.
So, Alex, when did you decide to emigrate to the U.S., and how did you pull that off?
I don't know. Honestly, well, there's some changes going around me, but obviously you remember this perestroika and all this stuff. It was also a lot of hot air in this. And in reality, how do you change people? Obviously, you don't. So the structure, the hierarchy, if you wish, in my area, in chess, it basically remained the same. And I looked at this, and I didn't see any future for myself, to be honest, in that structure. So I wanted to try my chess in a different setting. some different part of the world. You know, I use the term the green pastures,
right?
But I don't mean it in a degrading sense. You know, well, it's just I don't know. It just felt, but it wasn't really about my chess career. All the same, somehow I felt okay. I'm 30 years old and no, I know where it is. I know what's going on around me, and I can. Even with that uncertainty of the perestroika and all that, you know, it was hard for me to feel excited about my life, you know, looking forward. Maybe I had an early midlife crisis.
Right. So
yeah, I don't know.
So you were about 30 years old, and if you had stayed in Leningrad, what was in front of you? What would your life have been like professionally?
No, professionally, I don't really know, because at that time, a lot of things were falling apart. So the old structures of having a job as a chess coach somewhere, you know, probably would be impossible. But I don't even know if I would have stayed with chess, to be honest, if I remained over there. I mean, I had a lot of friends outside of chess, and they were going to different business things, and there was a lot of risk taken over there. I don't know.
And what was your last job in Leningrad? Were you still in the army, or were you still
working? Yeah, well, I was. I resigned my position as a coach in the Central Army. Is that Central? No, okay, in the Army Chess Club over there. I resigned my position there. It was, I think, about 6 months prior to leaving the country.
Okay. And what was the process of emigrating to the U.S.? Did you?
There was a lot of paperwork and a lot of lying, you know. Like, I mean, I don't know. So I wouldn't want to delve into that. No, I'm not particularly proud of some things I did, you know, in order to get out of there. But I don't think life treated me so fairly before that I owe anything to anybody.
Now you're making me curious.
No, nothing, you know. So no, I didn't break any laws, put it this way. I didn't leave any trail of bodies behind me.
Okay. No. Just chess pieces. Captured chess pieces. Okay, and once you got to the U.S., where was your first stop?
I didn't travel directly to the United States. I got out of the Soviet Union, and honestly, I didn't care much where I would go. So I ended up in Italy, and I lived there for about 9 months or so. And for a while, I wasn't doing any chess, you know. I was kind of thinking of going to the United States, and basically what I was doing, me and a couple of guys I befriended over there, I was just going to the U.S. Embassy in Rome and sitting there in the library watching CNN and reading some magazines, kind of brushing, I mean, learning English, basically. I did study English as part of my general education in the Soviet Union, but no, obviously the real thing was way different. So I was doing this for a while, you know, but then I kind of got a little tired, you know, of not doing anything. So then I found some chess players there and started traveling from one tournament to another. And perhaps surprisingly for myself too, I did extremely well. I won a lot of tournaments over there, and a lot of people wanted me to stay in Italy. There was a fair chance that I would be able to stay there.
Where in Italy were you?
In Rome.
Okay. And did you speak Italian?
I picked up some Italian then. It's all gone, you know, from my head, you know. But by the end of that period, 7 or 8 months, you know, I could converse somehow.
And so by now you were a grandmaster. And
no, I was not a grandmaster.
Oh, okay. So
I was. No, well, there are also things. Okay, I won those tournaments, but what to do with them? Suppose, you know, I even had one GM norm from one of those. Had enough grandmasters and all that, and the average rating. But what do you do with that? Well, you can't declare yourself a grandmaster. You have to be part of something. You have to be part of a chess federation somewhere, and that federation would file an application on your part to the FIDE Ratings and Title Committee, or whatever it was called then, where you submit all the documentation. And I was, as they, officially I was a stateless person. I have no permanent residency anywhere, and I was no part of any existing chess governing body. If I stayed this way, I would probably keep on drifting from. But eventually, I had to do something, right? Not only because of chess. I mean, so it was either staying in Italy, but suddenly, you know, all this opportunity came for me to travel. I mean, to move to the United States, which was rather unexpected.
So
because I didn't really ask for it.
So what happened? Did someone reach out to you, or you?
Well, So somehow, you know, since Italy was hosting guys like us only temporary. Well, basically, eventually, either U.S. or Canada, Australia, you know, some countries, you know, that were taking immigrants, you know, would take us off their hands. I guess there was some kind of pressure, so they found me somewhere on the list of whatever random people, and found the. No, it's not like I wasn't. I wasn't arrested or anything. You know, they would just send a postcard, you know, to that place where I had in Rome, so I should come to this organization that would arrange my travel to the United States.
And was this?
And I thought for a while, you know, my first intention was to throw it in garbage. You know, then there is no way they would have found me. Who cares?
Was this a chess organization or?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, okay.
No. Chess had nothing to do with that. Wow. Chess was my personal thing.
Hobby, basically. Still.
No, well, it's something that I did, but yeah. Okay.
So where did you move when you did come to the U.S.?
I came to the New York, New Jersey area. Okay. Well, I kind of bounced around, but then I tell you what, the most important thing that I realized coming to the United States that I was simply not ready. So I needed some time to hunker down, you know, and work on my English and also learn things around me. Otherwise, you know, I felt out of place. I did what every immigrant should do when they come here.
So you lived
just isolate himself from all the ties with your old country, you know, the old community, whatever. Plunge yourself and take a simple job somewhere, even if you're overqualified for that, and simply make your way in life.
So what job?
And it's not going to take a long time, you know, only a few years you need. And then you can, after that, you can sit down and think, what do I really want to do?
So what job did you take?
Oh, I took a job as a lab technician for a pharmaceutical company.
Okay.
I did have enough background in chemistry because I studied nuclear physics back in the Soviet Union. Chemistry obviously was there part of. So anyway, there was enough. And besides, in reality, no, I don't know. It's not really a scientist position. It's somewhere between a scientist and a dishwasher. So that's okay. I could handle both ends.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what was your last non-chess job? Was that it?
So that was my last non-chess job. It lasted 3 years. And I quit it in the year 1993.
Wow.
And so, since then, you know, I don't think I made a dime anywhere outside of chess.
Yeah, well, by 93, my recollection is you were already making a lot of noise on the U.S. chess scene, winning tournaments and climbing the rating ladder.
Well, yeah, because, it's Piscataway, New Jersey. No, as crow flies, you know, I think it's 30 miles from the Columbus Circle, so I'm not that far away from New York. So I have nothing to do, so I lived in that small almost unfurnished apartment. You know. So I come home from work, eat something, and get in the car, you know, and push my way through traffic to come to Manhattan Chess Club, the old one that used to be in the Carnegie Building over there on 57th, and later Marshall Chess Club as well. So I would play tournaments one after another.
Okay, and how long did you, I know you eventually, you've lived in a few places in the U.S., so how long did you stay in New York? Or it was Piscataway?
Well, in New Jersey, yeah. I stayed there for 2 more years after I quit my job and became full-time chess professional. Actually, the Grandmaster thing, you know, it was very strange because of my success in those tournaments, and I also played the World Open or two, I gained a lot of rating, and USCF took me into consideration for the U.S. Olympic team year 1992. The Olympiad was in Manila, Philippines. And they put me on board, too, which probably was surprising for some of my teammates. But I did okay. Well, I mean, I scored that GM norm. And then John Donaldson, who was our team captain, which I affectionately always call Major Donaldson. You know, so Major Donaldson, you know, looked up and said, Alex, you know, you're making a GM norm. Did you have any before? I go, I don't know, there's World Open tournaments. And one tournament I played in Italy. So he slapped together some paperwork on that. You know, the World Open was not a given thing because at that time, FIDE would not accept any norms from 2 games a day tournaments. But, I mean, I would say probably they looked at everything. My performance on board too and the rating, which was at 26-15 at the time. They figured, well, this guy is a grandmaster. So they closed their eyes on certain irregularities in my application.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it would have happened sooner or later, as you say.
So the reason I'm telling you all this, because a lot of people, like if you ask very established player like Alexander Shabalov, he can tell you a story of his chasing his last GM norm. It happened to almost everybody. You know, he can be a great player, but the pressure of getting that one last norm is always there. But I never had it, because I never thought of that.
Okay. And when you did get the GM title, was there a noticeable difference in your professional opportunities?
No, I was still working for that company in New Jersey. So I came back, you know, well, I had to take some leave of absence and all that. They weren't very happy with me. And I think mainly because if I understood this correctly, they just didn't want people who had something else in life.
Huh.
You know, so they figured, okay, this guy is not fully committed to whatever, to that company goals and whatever. It wasn't a big company. They ended up sold to a larger company in New Jersey, and then they started relocating that plant and the production area to Memphis, Tennessee. And that was another thing I didn't want to do. Nothing against Tennessee, except that the New Jersey climate was not very good for me. I mean, the weather, you know, summers, I didn't like it. And I thought, you know, in Tennessee, and it's already the south.
You missed the St. Petersburg winters, huh?
No, well, yeah, it's not only what you're used to, it's also your genetics and all that, you know, I feel much more comfortable. Right now, we're having this nice conversation, and let me see, it's 17 degrees outside, and it's light snow. Okay, so that's perfect.
I'm not sure all our listeners will agree, but it does sound like you found the right place.
To each their own, you know. I didn't grow up watching Endless Spring Break on MTV.
Uh-huh.
So I feel different about life. I mean, we're all entitled to our opinions, right?
Of course. So you made your way to Cleveland, if I'm correct, right?
I had some personal issues there, and I wanted a change of scenery, so I decided to leave New Jersey. And the Cleveland thing, that was another, decision-making. They say, you're a chess player, you know a lot about decision-making, you make decisions. And I go, okay, no, let me tell you a story about decision-making. So a friend of mine, you've heard the name, Grandmaster Alexander Golden.
Yes, of course.
He was bouncing around a lot, you know, so he was, between divorces and whatever, and his family relocated to Israel, and He, anyway, so he comes to New Jersey and we're about to play another World Open. It was the year 1995. And so we just went to a liquor store, you know, got a couple of six packs, you know, and I went to a park, you know, sit there, you know. So it was already dark, drinking beer and talking about life. And I go, look, I've decided, you know, I'm moving out of here. Enough is enough. He said, where do you want to go? I have no idea. No, my car is parked right there. So we took this Rand McNally, you know, Atlas, and a flashlight because it was too dark. And I started, you know, looking, oh, this place looks nice. It's Cleveland, right? I mean, besides, it's the butt end of all these jokes.
Right.
Right. So I figured, okay, just to... That's part of this, right? So when something has like real bad name, like the South Dakota weather, or Cleveland, you know, with the Cuyahoga River catching fire and all this stuff, you know, I remember some of those Cleveland jokes. I'll tell you one. So anyway, it kind of felt the right place for me. So I said, I'm going to Cleveland. And indeed, you know, once we swept the beer off, you know, the next morning I drove to Cleveland.
That's
just
amazing.
Voice out. No, amazing. I was only what... was less than 500 miles.
And you and did you make a trip back to New Jersey, or did you just
No, I did have to go back. No, well, I was a responsible individual. I got some stuff there, and I had to settle some personal matters. But I already had a place. I already rented a place in Cleveland. That was the purpose of that first trip.
Did you have any connections there, or did you?
Oh, I made a connection actually, thanks to Gregory Kaidanov. He introduced me to a guy, a local chess player. We're still big friends. I talked to him yesterday on the phone, as a matter of fact. Well, he's a bookseller and an high A expert level chess player. His name is Larry Rust, R-U-S-T.
Yes, yes, I know the name.
Yeah, and so we're big friends. We're on the phone all the time. And no, he was my best friend then in Cleveland.
And so,
helped me a lot, you know. We played tennis every day, you know, weather permitting.
Right.
So we would start playing tennis in March, you know, and we would play it really every day. You know, that's how I became a better chess player, simply through physical conditioning.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of the younger generation is emphasizing these days.
Yeah. Now, it's the chess. In chess, it's becoming more and more important to be physically strong. Look at these guys, you know, like Carlsen, Karjakin. Well, Karjakin did a lot to improve his physical conditioning. He probably did not become as strong as Carlsen, which is near impossible.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, he was able. He had enough for 12 games.
Okay. Well, Alex, I'm really enjoying this this stroll down memory lane because I feel like it takes us through a lot of modern chess history. So you do so much teaching online now, but in Cleveland in the late 90s, how did a chess player make a living?
Well, I had another friend, you know. He was originally from the Soviet Union, Boris Mann. He was international master. We swapped together something that we called Yerma Chess Academy, which was basically kind of group lesson seminar thing, you know. We had it over the weekend. Well, we had it in Cleveland once a month, and then a different part of Ohio and Springfield, which is... Well, kind of near Columbus, you know, in the central part of the states. But mainly, that was real small. Mainly, I was deriving my income from winning tournaments. Because I really played well at that time, and I wanted only to focus on that. I figured, you know, like when I will have time later in life to do more teaching.
Makes sense. Seems like a good decision. And were you making a decent living, or was it like... struggle.
I was never in debt, you know. I was never late paying my taxes, you know. I don't know what it is. I always had good, no, fairly new car, you know, like that.
Right.
And that was the thing I needed always, you know, a reliable vehicle. But I mean, I'm not really big on clothes, you know, any
right.
kind of expensive entertainment, and probably there is a minimalistic streak in me, you
mm-hmm.
know. Well, I think it's good, you know. I always appreciate this, particularly in men, you know, when if they can get by with minimum things.
Yeah.
Excess, I don't like.
Right. So when you were playing games to earn a living, did you feel a lot of pressure competing for prizes in the actual games?
Well, obviously, but... No, well, this pressure comes anyway, and having to pay rent, you know, is just one of them. You know, nobody wants to lose, right? Everybody wants to win. In fact, you know, that helps because the drive, you know, is essential. Once the player becomes satisfied with his position in life and chess, you know, usually that's the beginning of decline.
Right. But you weren't actively thinking about the money in terms of like these high stakes, you know, games for $15,000, $20,000 in the last round of a World Open.
No, yeah, you know, lovely, you know, like that's what gets your adrenaline going. And I trained myself to do this in some ways because I had so many of these pressure games later when I started traveling more to Europe in the late 1990s, playing there. I played a few Opens there, and I could tell that most of people around me, they just wanted to make a bunch of draws in the last round and secure some prize money. And I would just slice through them like a hot knife butter, you know, and win a tournament. Because I played every game to win. White or black didn't matter.
Was that a natural instinct for you or something that you trained to do?
Well, I guess, you know, I had to do this because what's the use of finishing 4th or 5th, you know, in an open tournament in the United States. There is no use.
So did you cultivate a chess style based on playing for wins for black?
It screwed up my style, exactly. That's what people told me, that, well, I probably could have been a more, with my kind of chess training coming from the old days, although I was never really totally mainstream. I had my own ways of looking at chess, and I talked about this in that book, Road to Chess Improvement. But nonetheless, you know, probably my style would be more classical, more in a vein of, say, Alexander Anishuk, you know. But I drifted away from that because I had to play open tournaments for a living.
And transitioning to more current times, so these days you don't play as much. What made you decide to scale back on the amount of time that you play?
No, the decision actually came much earlier. The decision came in the late 1990s. Well, when I got married to Camila and all that. And obviously, I realized that the lifestyle that I had, traveling across the Atlantic, you know, 5 times a year, you know, it's unacceptable when you're a married person and you're trying to raise a family and all that. So I was kind of thinking of what to do. And then my dumb luck worked again, you know. So I got this job offer from Mechanics Institute Chess Club in San Francisco, California. And that kind of solved my problems. It was sort of similar to that job in New Jersey. Once again, I kind of hunkered down, you know, just to... But this time I needed the time to adjust not to a new country and new culture and new language, but to adjust to married life with kids.
And did you live in San Francisco proper back
then? I did not. I live in the East Bay on the north part, you know, in Richmond.
Okay.
It's north of Berkeley. And before that, I lived in El Cerrito, which is the next town north of Berkeley. And then I continued to Richmond. Well, place has a bad name, you know. There is a lot of disenfranchised people over there. There are a lot of crime and drugs and all that, you know. But, well, we lived in a new development in a condominium, but you have to watch your step every time you leave here.
Yeah, I lived in Oakland in the early 2000s.
Well, yeah, no, that's the reality over there. But
yeah.
Maybe that's another thing that I got a little tired of, you know. Like, I have to think, okay, what time is it? You know, is it too late when my wife's coming by BART from San Francisco? I should go to BART station and pick her up.
Yeah, probably not as much of an issue in Sioux Falls.
That kind of stuff, you know, started grating on me a little bit.
Yeah. And so what were you... When you worked for the Mechanics Institute, did you give lectures or what was your job?
Well, I did all sorts of things, you know, like making sure that there is toilet paper in the bathroom was one of them.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I was good at that, you know. So this is general manager of a chess club. See, John Donaldson, you know, who was the director and still is the director of chess club. Well, John has many interests in different interests in life, you know, and he's not really a kind of a, what you call a... a worker. Uh-huh. He has a lot of Yasser Seirawan on him because they were friends and they worked together in Seattle for the Inside Chess, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Great magazine.
Extinct public, now, of course, publication, defunct. But so John is a man of vision. He likes projects. And, well, it takes time and it takes focus and devotion. So, well, I was the guy, you know, to taking care of daily workings of the chess club. I had a great help from Steven Brandwine. I don't know if you heard that name. He's a great guy, you know. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. There was a short obituary on his. Steve was a great guy, and he was a part-time worker there. So basically, Steve and I, they sat there every day in the club, and we ran those tournaments and made sure that every player there, you know, paid his entry fee and had his USCF membership in good standing. I also kind of put together a sort of rudimentary website, you know, for the club, you know, reporting results and, you know, having some links there at the tournament tables and all that.
That's amazing to think, because it I know that Simon Williams, a previous guest, has talked about how some grandmasters don't. They can be a little spoiled about the job responsibilities they want to take on. So it's funny to think of you, who's such an esteemed grandmaster here in the U.S., to be changing the toilet paper and keep, you know, turning the lights on and off and stuff like that.
Well, hey, you know, like, that's part of it, you know. Like, well, my wife would, well, it was different. No, I mean, I had to do a lot of things, you know, in life, you know, so I learned, you know, to take those things in stride, you know, like maybe I wouldn't mind, you know, sitting somewhere in a nice office, you know, and then wearing a white shirt and a tie. But I mean, if I have to get my hands dirty, I will. Okay. Not a problem. I actually enjoy it in some ways, you know. So in some ways, you know, my path in life is easier, right? So I avoid big responsibility. I don't go for anything big. Not being a man of vision has its advantages.
This is true.
Yeah. Minimalism. We're talking about minimalism.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. So I feel like we've caught up to your current life in South Dakota, and you've been doing some announcing for the Pro Chess League. You have your weekly show on the Internet Chess Club. So how what's got your attention in modern chess right now?
Well, It's interesting. I guess every period in chess history was interesting. But right now, I still think it's a transition period because, no, I think finally, about 5 years ago, I still felt, you know, that people were, they're incredulous. Like, how come Magnus Carlsen, the best player in the world, ignores, you know, like this... openings, right? But by ignoring openings, Magnus basically ignores that presumption that white has to try for an advantage out of the opening. And the larger, the better. And the ultimate goal is to have a prepared win, like Garry Kasparov school of chess, right? And Magnus is absolutely different. But I think the players now came around to understand that, well, it's their reaction in some ways to computer invasion, intrusion of computers into chess preparation. So look, all these lines, you know, like the long, sharp theoretical variations, the Botvinniks, the entire Moscow Gambit, the Poisson Pawn variation, they're not really that heavily used, right?
Yeah.
People play the London system, the Berlin, and they just play chess. You know, in some ways, it's interesting. Although we do have a problem, because it kind of levels out the possibilities and maybe robs some of the colors, you know. So in the sense that there isn't really a whole lot you can do in such positions.
Yeah.
Maybe it's enough for Magnus, but I mean, for others, they play this because it's fashionable, and that's what do I do with that? And that's why we have. Often we have draws and all that. I mean, the solution to this is very simple, and it wasn't me who came up with this. It was one of the top players, Grishuk, who said, you know, we just should do away with classical chess and just play rapid only. Nobody needs 2 hours anymore. I agree with Grishuk that the quality of games does not drop out at all.
Yeah, I agree we've had a few guests on who've talked about this topic, and I think that more agree than disagree, although the people who disagree are quite strident in their defense of the six-hour games.
Fine. Well, yeah. I personally, you know, you say that I don't play enough. My problem is that last time I played in the Goldschmidt tournament was in Las Vegas, the North American Open, which I had played before, I don't know, so many times. Anyway, so I go there and I'm having a good tournament. I went through the opening rounds efficiently, and here I am playing Wesley So, and I'm very excited because I know it's my one and only chance to play Wesley. So it's not like I prepared for the game chess-wise, but I came to the game on time, you know, and I sat there, and I'm about to start the game. And then they make this announcement, don't start your games, we're changing pairings for the under 1700 section. And this and that, you know, like the start of the game was delayed by 35 minutes. Okay, I probably would have lost to Wesley anyway, but I mean, it totally threw me off, you know, that was just disgusting.
Yeah, that's a bit frustrating.
And this tournament, I end up spending 13 hours, you know, in the tournament hall. I mean, why do I want to do that? You know, it's just, they need to shorten time controls. Two games a day, I understand, you know, but when I come to Spice Cup, which is very efficiently run by Susan, you know, over there we have this game 90 with the increment time control. Your game takes somewhere between 3 and 4 hours. Different story. You have time to rest between the games, eat and all that. I mean, this Goldschmidt model was totally dated, you know, and then I just don't want to do this.
Yeah.
If they had faster time controls, maybe rapid tournaments, I would be even happy. I would travel and play more.
So do you think that would solve? You also mentioned the opening problem, though, of how much computers are affecting how much theory people need to remember. Do you think that would help with that problem?
It would help a lot, Ben. I gotta tell you, the reason people are kind of follow the script, you know, all these recommendations and being afraid to step away and take chances is because, you're gonna be punished, and then what? When you play a rapid tournament, you know that the next game is gonna start in 5 minutes after you finish that one. People would take more risks. They always do.
Okay.
You know, you just have more games to make up for whatever an unfortunate game that you had. Try to do this in this Grand Chess Tour tournament. I mean, look what happened to Ding Liren, for example, in this latest FIDE Grand Prix tournament. He gets good pairings, right, in round one. He has white pieces against Richard Rapport. I mean, Richard is a great guy and a very talented player, but still, Ding was the favorite, right? It gets the white pieces, and Rapport plays his kind of risky chess, you know, and Ding's breaking through the center, and he's about to finish his attack and win the game, right? And then something happens, and he misses one move and another one, and gets low on time and loses. It's a disaster. He lost the game with white, and how do you make up for it in a 9-round tournament, where every game is going to be tough? He finally managed to climb back to plus one, but that's all he did. When you play a rapid tournament, well, there's going to be more games, so people will have room to make up for some mistakes and unfortunate games. I think they won't be so afraid.
Okay. Well, I think a lot of listeners, we've talked about this topic a lot, and I think a lot of listeners agree, but it's definitely interesting to hear your perspective because you've had so much success in classical chess. I wanted to switch gears a little bit. You, in your pro chess announcing, I think the stuff I've heard and from what I've seen, I really enjoy your coverage. You had one little segment that got a lot of attention where you were talking about your frustration with FIDE. Do you mind for our listeners talking a little bit about what troubles you about the way their tournaments are run?
All right. FIDE in itself, I'm not against an international organization per se. Well, I think FIDE should exist. What I have a problem with is the particular people who's been sitting there and feeding from the trough, you know, for the past 20 years plus. Well, I can name names. You know, there is still there. There is Makropoulos there. There is Leong there. There is Azmai Parashvili in the wings. And these guys, you know, they're not really pleasant people if you know them in person. You know, they use and abuse the system. And, first of all, we need to get rid of these people one way or another. Drain the swamp.
Right? Sounds familiar.
So that's number one, you know. Like as far as the delegating the rights to run chess championship tournaments from Grand Prix on to the candidates world championship match to Aegon, which is basically kind of a strange entity. No, it doesn't have any presence in physical world. But I mean, it's over my head. I don't really know how to run these things. And I can run a scholastic tournament, which I run here in Sioux Falls every month, you know, but that's like for 40 or 50 kids, you know. That's the extent of my expertise.
Right.
So I don't really know how, but what Aegon is known for is that since they don't have permanent staff, they don't have permanent headquarters, there are really no people doing that grunt work, right?
Right.
No people who sit there and change the toilet paper rolls over there. They just do not exist. Therefore, everything's late. They were late getting their official team of commentators for the Sharjah tournament. It was totally butchered. You know, it's literally, I spoke with some people. They said, well, this thing was up in the air as far as, am I going there to commentate on the games as late as 3 days before the start of the tournament?
Wow.
Now, this is unacceptable.
Yes.
You know, somebody just, it's not really that difficult. It's not really that difficult to run world's chess. I said that I had no experience with that, but I had no experience with the most important part is where to get the money. But once the budget is there, you know, I think it shouldn't be that difficult to get people to come to work on time, you know, and do what's required. And that's been a problem.
So what's the way out of this?
I don't know. Make me world's dictator. I'll fix a lot of things.
Okay, I second the motion.
All right.
So do we have any chance? I mean, I know Kasparov ran to be head of FIDE in the most recent election. Do you see any way of leadership change or change from within occurring in the near future?
I have hopes. I'm sure that Kirsan is ready to retire. I think his efforts, you know, to defeat Kasparov were mainly caused by Kasparov himself. I think if it was somebody else but Kasparov, maybe Kirsan even wouldn't have run.
So you think it was a personal thing?
Well, I think the way Gary does it, for Gary, everything is just this kind of a, you know, kind of a personal issue. That's how he is. Ultimately, he's a chess player, so he lives his life like he plays another chess game, and there is a lot of intimidation there, and this I don't know. It's just that's the reason why he couldn't succeed. Well, he made another tactical error, you know. So a lot of people say that Garry Kasparov is very smart because he was a world champion. Well, maybe he is, but. But I mean, look how he approached this. All he was talking about, you know, USCF and some important European countries, you know, we don't care about anybody else. He made really a half-hearted effort, you know, to reach to African delegates anywhere, you know. And all he could talk about, I was on CNN last night and, you know, I wrote this in Wall Street Journal. Most people on this planet actually will detest that. I mean, it's the reality.
Yeah.
He still lives like in the 1980s. Like, okay, if closer to America you are, the more popular you are in the world. There is no Soviet Union anymore, Gary. You know, I think that was a big tactical error on his part, you know. And a lot of people didn't want him because they thought that this guy is just so pro-Western Europe, pro-American, you know. He's going to totally neglect our interests, whatever they are. It's not like those guys are angels. Obviously, they're bureaucrats, and they're probably not doing nearly as much as they should to promote chess in their countries. But fact of the matter is, they're other delegates. And if you don't play the political game right, you're going to lose.
Interesting. That's interesting. I've never heard that perspective. I mean, I've heard people mention the possibility that, you know, certain delegates are in Fidesz's pocket, and that was part of what...
No, well, they're in the pocket because they look... No, okay, so they look at Fidesz, they see Kirsan, you know, like, okay, so Kirsan, well, maybe in the eyes of an American public, you know, Kirsan is just a Russian guy, but this guy, look at this difference. So they see that they're maybe closer to them, maybe racially, or it's a small... I mean, the Kalmyks are small ethnicity, you know, and they're Buddhists, you know, and all that. They relate better to this, maybe in many ways. This thing, it exists, you know, you can't ignore it. When you beat your chest and saying, you know, look at all this, you know, I'm friends with the German Chess Federation and the USCF and all this, you know, no, maybe in a different organization, you know, if they broke up FIDE and made a different organization, which Kasparov had, you know, like, maybe he's the right person to run it. What do I know? But, I mean, for FIDE, you know, it's just, it wasn't going to work.
Well, Alex, I only have a couple more questions. I really appreciate your coming on. This has been amazing. One that I can't let you go without asking is, in your book, you talk a little bit, and you also mentioned having some six-packs with Grandmaster Golden. You talk about doing blindfold analysis with GMs Svidler and Kramnik at a bar in Weekend Z. Was that a metaphor?
Not a metaphor. It was absolutely not. Why would it be a metaphor? You know.
Like, well, you were talking.
I mean, okay, let's bring it to this issue of chess as part of the Olympic family, you know, and of course, doping control and all that, right? So that's related somewhat. We should not forget one thing, but at least the chess what I played was chess for adults. I mean, it was a sport for adults. I mean, well, most of Olympic disciplines, you have, I don't know, 18 to 20-year-old kids over there. So different rules apply to them. Speaking of doping control, you know, like, I mean, probably a lot of chess players, you know, well, they carry, you know, medication with them and whatever. They have to take a doctor's orders and all that. Now, as far as, you know, these methods of relaxation, I'm by no means, you know, I'm not a heavy drinker, at least not anymore. I don't even recall last time I had a drink. But I mean, chess tournaments, they're a different pace. You have to be there at the same place, you know, for many days over there. And indeed, sometimes you need to break that routine. And going to a bar to have a drink maybe wasn't such a bad idea. At least it didn't affect Kramnik or Svidler very badly. Besides, we would get to play some snooker,
nice.
Which is always great.
Yeah. No,
one thing that I don't have in Sioux Falls. Sioux Falls, South Dakota does not have a single snooker table in the whole city of 175,000 people.
Wow. That sounds like something you might need to fix with
Well, it needs a fix, yeah.
In,
well,
in your golden years.
Extremely expensive.
Yeah.
Your tables are extremely expensive. I don't think I can ever afford this.
Okay.
Too bad. So I answered another question that you had in mind. What is your dream? What do you dream of? I dream of a snooker table.
Okay. Well, I think it's attainable, personally. Okay, and lastly, I just wanted to talk about what else you're interested in. And I saw that in your chess.com profile, you're wearing an A's jersey. Are you a baseball fan?
Yeah, I still am a baseball fan. I don't know. Well, the A's... Well, okay, anyway, there is always a next season. Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, I follow them, not as religiously as I did my first years in South Dakota. But I mean, that's my team, the Oakland A's, yeah.
It's hard enough to follow a losing team when you live in the place, but when you don't live there, it becomes easier to disengage.
Yeah, I guess, you know, see what happens, you know. Like, I don't have near the commitment I had when I had season tickets when I lived in Oakland. So I would have to attend a lot of games, so I just throw them away, right?
Right.
I already paid for them. So right now, what's my commitment? $125 paid to MLB .TV,
right,
to watch those games. It's not a big deal. I can do that.
What other interests do you have outside of chess?
Well, great outdoors in the South Dakota, of course. So people come from all over the place, you know, to do hunting and fishing here. And, well, I mean, obviously I partake in this.
What about your kids? What are they into?
Every time I see my daughter, you know, she has her cell phone in her hand. I don't know. Well,
my son, right?
He studies computers, and he's a pretty good player in this magic and similar games, the strategy games.
Okay.
There's a club over here. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, right? Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, Magic the Gathering and similar stuff. So he's active over there, and he's a pretty good player at that, you know. I guess that's what took him away from chess, but
okay,
that's fine.
Okay, well, Alex, I can't think of any more questions. This I really enjoyed hearing all these stories and hearing about your career and your move from place to place.
Yeah, Cleveland in particular. Oh, I promised the Cleveland thing. Okay, one was an old movie with John Candy. You remember this actor, you know, I think he's dead.
Yes.
A movie was his character there was a playwright. I forgot the title of the movie. So the guy sits in front of his typewriter and basically, no, types a script. But script comes to life and he gets drawn into this. And the only way he can change the course of events is to get back to that magic typewriter of his and type something, right? Otherwise, things spin out of control. So that's the premise of the movie, right?
Okay.
So at some moment, he sits there and he has to type something real important because there's a love interest there and things go wrong, you know, and all that, you know. And suddenly, you know, well, door opens and in walks a guy, you know, like in zoot suit, you know, and a fedora hat, you know, like, and points a gun at him. And the John Candy character looks up and says, "What are you doing here? I thought I sent you to Cleveland." The guy goes, "I should kill you for that alone."
You're not going to make a lot of friends in Cleveland with that.
Oh, no, they all love that stuff. I live there. They eat it up.
Okay. And now they're on top of the world with their sports teams.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Ascendant.
I mean, Cleveland, you know, it wasn't so bad, come to think of that, you know.
Yeah.
So no.
I know I enjoyed my 2 days there. That's all I can say.
So that was my parting gift, you know, from this. And
okay.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, well, people can find you on ICC and on chess.com. I think so. I really appreciate your coming on, Alex. Thanks for all the great stories and insight.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Perpetual Chess. To hear more episodes, give feedback, or suggest guests, go to perpetualchesspod.com. If you like the show, please help me out by telling your friends and giving me a high rating on iTunes. I'll be back next week with another episode of the Perpetual Chess Podcast.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.